Sean, it's good to see you. You're in Denver. I am in New Jersey. It is Wednesday as we record this. I'll be heading to Carolina tonight. But what we already know is something I didn't expect, and I don't think you did either, Sean. The Tampa Bay Lightning moving on. Maybe we expected that, or we could have predicted that. But sweeping the Florida Panthers in the second round? Are you kidding me?
No, I mean, that's what happened. Nobody's kidding anybody, but look, I like that Florida team. I picked Tampa to win, and I picked Tampa to win for the reasons that they won. They know how to win. They showed it. They have the better goaltender. They're probably a deeper team when it comes to playing 200-foot hockey, but I expected a 6 or 7-game series. I expected this to be one of the series that we were sitting around 2 weeks from now, you know, chomping at the bit for elimination games in games 6 and 7, and Florida, they had no answers. And to me, it's unbelievably disappointing. Like I, the Florida Panthers are the new San Jose Sharks for me. Back in the day, every year I'd pick the Sharks. Oh, the Sharks are going to win it this year. This is the year that they're going to do it. They're going to go really deep. And every year I'd get disappointed. And then I finally punted on them. And then they went to the Stanley Cup final against the Penguins and, you know, lost that series. But Florida, every year I'm like, this is the team. I really like them. I like their pieces. And they can't put it together. And this one is more heartbreaking than all of them because they were an absolute wagon going into the playoffs.
They definitely were, and we'll break a lot of this down. There's a lot to break down with our guest, Ryan Callahan, former player with the Lightning and the Rangers, and does some great work on ESPN now. He's going to join us, and there's a lot there that we talk with him about on this Panthers-Lightning series. But let's get into just a little bit of it on our own here, Sean. The Florida Panthers, look, the Florida Panthers scored 3 goals in this series. They averaged more than 4 per game in the regular season. They scored 3 in 4 games. Their power play was abysmal in the playoffs, 1 for 31. I think what happens here is they look back at the playoffs that they had here, 2 rounds, and they go, why couldn't we fix the power play? That's the biggest question. Why couldn't we fix the power play? If they could fix the power play, maybe the results are of some of these 4 games they played against Tampa are a little different, and maybe they're still playing, but they couldn't fix the power play. They couldn't generate offense. And it's shocking that they were not able to do that because of how good they were offensively. If they were going to lose in the playoffs, to me, it would have been because they couldn't score enough to win. You know what I mean? Like they would be giving up too much because that's the type of team they had. They could win 5-4. They could win 6-5. They could fall down 5-2 or 6-2 and come back and win 7-6. They couldn't do any of that. They didn't even come close.
They played a pretty special goalie and they played a pretty special system. I mean, you know, Tampa Bay knows how to play playoff hockey. My God, they've had such a long run at it, you know, especially a run of success they're in right now, 10 straight series wins. I mean, they've made some pretty good teams look ordinary, and they made a really good Florida team look ordinary. And I think Andre Vasilevsky took away their will to a degree, and goalies will do that. And you know, I think Vasilevsky has that special talent where he can get inside the head of an entire offense. You know, when their power play didn't work against Washington and Washington goalies weren't in, I'm not even going to put him in the same zip code as Andre Vasilevsky, but he, meaning Vasilevsky, has made a lot of really good scorers look like rookies. Mm-hmm. And that happened here. And you just kind of saw as the series went on, like things weren't working and it just got to them and they weren't able to get out of their own way and put it behind them and say, okay, this happens in the course of a series. We're going to figure this out. Our time's going to come. They never believed their time was going to come in this series, I don't think.
Yeah. Look, there's a lot I want to get to with the Panthers, but you brought up Vasilevsky. So I got to ask the question, is this guy on his way to becoming the best goalie of all time?
If he keeps playing like he is, right? Like, what do we judge success on?
Winning in the playoffs. Yeah.
Winning in the playoffs. And look, goalies are a separate deal because wins are, everybody wants to say they're a team stat, and to a degree they are. Is Vasilevsky as good a goalie as he is because of what's happening around him and the culture of his team and the skill level and the 200-foot game that they play? Of course he is. Is he also an elite game-changing, game-stealing goalie? Yes. Mm-hmm. So if they continue to win, he's in that Mount Rushmore of goalies, of the guys you, when you speak of goalies, you're like, that's the guy. You know, is it him? Is it Patrick Waugh? Is it Martin Brodeur? You know, is it Dominic Hasek, who, you know, didn't win quite as much as those three other guys that I just mentioned, but he's right there. And then I think it just becomes a preference thing, right? Like, I grew up in hockey watching Marty Brodeur from day one until day whatever it was when he finally said, that's it, I'm done. You know, and I saw every special thing he did. So there's certainly a bias there. And the numbers suggest that there'll never be anybody quite like him. Vasilevsky's making me rethink that.
You know, it's similar, though, with Brodeur and Vasilevsky. It was the same core, right, that Brodeur won with over the years that he won with in the playoffs. It was mostly the same core. It was mostly the same defenseman. Spread over a longer period of time, I guess, in terms of championships. But Vasilevsky's been doing this for a while with this core in place. So I do think that there are some similarities to that, you know. And, you know, with Patrick Waugh, he won with two different teams, right? I mean, with Dominic Hasek, it was a core in Detroit that was there before he got there that they won with, right? So, but this was built together, just like Marty was built together with Scott Stevens and Scott Niedermeyer and Danico and others, right? It's the same thing with Vasilevsky, with Stamkos and Hedman and Kucherov and McDonough and these guys. It's all kind of built together. So I think there's a similarity there. And look, if he goes on and wins it again this year, I mean, the guy's won 10 straight playoff rounds. His 6 career shutouts in closeout games. It's the first NHL goal, first goalie in NHL history to do that. It's remarkable what he is accomplishing. Because I think it's the same, because it's the same core, just like the Devils, I think if he goes on and does this again, and maybe again, I mean, he's right there, if not past what Marty did.
Yeah, and we talk about it, and I still don't think he gets enough credit for what he's done and for the piece he plays in that team. Look, the Tampa Bay Lightning have an unbelievable confidence born out of winning the Cup twice, winning 10 straight series. They believe that they can beat anybody. But part of that belief lies in the fact that if they make a mistake, Vasilevsky's going to clean it up. And that is so freeing for a team. They don't worry. They're going to sacrifice. They're going to play defense. But they don't worry if they pinch up, if they make a mistake. They're allowed to play free and take some chances because they have the human eraser in the background who 9 times out of 10 is going to take away the chance that comes from their mistake and allow them to continue playing. And they're never out of a game because their goalie never gives up multiple bad goals.
Look, we'll talk a lot more about Vasilevsky and the Lightning and whatnot with Ryan Callahan, our guest from ESPN, shortly. One last thing before we get to Callahan, though, Sean, back to the Panthers. So Andrew Brunette is an interim coach. And he is a finalist for the Jack Adams Award as Coach of the Year. But I think it's fair game to wonder if he's brought back because this team underperformed when it mattered most. To me, Andrew Brunette took over in really hard circumstances. Okay. It was not something anybody wanted. It was a hard circumstance that he took over for Joel Quenneville. And he did a really good job. He showed leadership. That team thrived under him. They were good. But in many respects, it was built. And in a lot of nights, all he had to do was throw the puck out on the ice and let the team go. That's underserving what Brunette did, because I do think he did show leadership and in a tough spot, and there was guidance there. But then you get to the playoffs, they weren't the same team. They didn't fix the power play. They couldn't get any offense going really until game 4 against the Lightning. And that's when Vasilevsky was dynamite with 49 saves. So I don't know what the decision is here, but with some of the names out there that are coaches right now that have had a history of success, I do wonder if the right move is to bring Andrew Brunette back, even though I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah, I personally think it's the right move. Look, and I know there's a lot of shiny toys on the shelves mm-hmm. right now, right? You know, Paul Maurice, Barry Trotz, all those guys that you know, we talk about ad nauseum. And could any of those guys help Florida get over the hump? Possibly. But you know what? John Cooper wasn't John Cooper until he became John Cooper. And he became John Cooper by getting schooled by other coaches.
Great point.
By learning. Like, if Andrew Brunette doesn't learn from this, then he's not your coach. But if Andrew Brunette spends the whole summer simmering about what happened and how he couldn't find the answers. And he comes back next year, having asked other coaches and other people that he trusts, you know, what did I do wrong here? Taking that inventory of what happened and says, I'm going to be better next year. My players, I'm going to make my players better next year. Like, the foundation is there. It seems to me that the Florida Panthers really like playing for Andrew Burnett, and that he stepped into a situation that I think very few humans could step into and say, we're going to be good. It's okay. Don't worry about the noise around us. I'm going to figure it out, and I'm going to get you to where you need to be. I think you need stability. And I think Andrew Burnett provides that stability. You won the President's Trophy. You can talk all you want about throwing the puck out there and letting their high-end players go and chase it. There's some teams here that are pretty talented where you can throw the puck out. You know, is Jared Bednar throw the puck out and let him go chase it? No. But same kind of situation. So they won the President's Trophy. Andrew Burnett did a few right things. He knows a thing or two about hockey. He spent a long apprenticeship figuring out what he wanted to do when he became a coach, and he was brave enough to do those things when he became the coach in really trying circumstances. So I think you bring him back. I think the harder question is figuring out where your window is, right? Your really good players are young, but you're facing a free agency crush in the next 2 years. You can't restock. You've given away all your draft capital and bringing in Sherratt and Giroux, who are free agents. There's some good stuff in the pipeline, but you're not going to be adding to it. So your window is now, but for how long?
You're right. I mean, that's Bill Zito's job to kind of figure that out, their general manager. But to Brunette, really good point there, Sean, on John Cooper. I agree with you. I also think if they were to give him the extension now, after getting swept, it's a real good sign of faith and confidence in the guy. If they had, and there's no question about their belief in him, had they given him the extension or made him the full-time coach prior to the playoffs, and then this happened, I wonder if there are people who'd be like, well, did they make the right decision? I don't know what happened. But if it happens now and they give him the full-time coach, there's no question, right? I mean, there's like, okay, yeah, we just saw what happened, but we don't care. You're our guy. We believe in you. And that's a sign of confidence and faith and trust in Andrew Burnett. And there would be zero doubt in his mind about the, you know, what they think of him. So that could be something interesting to look at too, and how he responds to just the timing of the decision, if it's made that he is named the full-time coach.
Yeah. And it'll be part of a really interesting offseason. Yes. But we're not there yet, Dan. We got 2.5 rounds to go. There's things happening in rinks across North America that just blow my mind on a nightly basis. And the guy who's been watching it all for ESPN, Ryan Callahan, is kind enough to join us. And I'm sure he has a lot to say on what's happened in the last week and a half.
He does. So here's that interview with Ryan Callahan. Ryan, thanks so much for jumping on with us. So let's just start with your former team. Well, one of your former teams, a sweep for the Tampa Bay Lightning. Ryan, I mean, I didn't see a sweep coming. Not surprised they won, but how does this team just keep doing this? You know this group. You know these guys. You played with a lot of them. How do they keep doing this?
Yeah, it's impressive, to be honest with you, to think about, you know, obviously after winning, just the hunger and the want after winning two Stanley Cups and coming into this year and still having that goal of trying to win and doing whatever it takes to win. And I think the best point of that is you talk to Corey Perry, and he says, before I signed with Tampa, I had a conversation with a couple of the guys there, and he goes, the biggest thing they said to me is they wanted to continue to win, and, you know, they still had that drive to win another Stanley Cup. And, you know, through those two runs I think they've had, and obviously through the years, even when I was there, when we got pretty close and we lost, they realized what it takes to win. And you saw that especially in game, you know, 6 and 7 against Toronto, and then all 4 games against Florida, and what it takes to win is worrying about your end first. This is a team, when I was there, that, you know, lived and died by offense, lived and died by, you know, making plays at the blue line. You know, and they've realized that puck management come playoff time is a huge thing. And then on top of that is the way they sacrifice themselves from the top guys all the way down through. And I thought that series against Florida was a perfect example of that, with the amount of block shots that was were happening, taking hits, giving hits. It was really impressive to see, and I think we can't talk about, you know, Tampa without talking about Vasilevsky. He is just a guy. I played with him, and I know how good he is, and I'm still in awe watching him. It's really, really impressive how he can raise his game when the moment is at the biggest. The biggest moments, he plays at his best. So right now they're playing the best hockey I've seen him play in a long time, and that says a lot knowing that they've won two championships. So we'll see what happens moving forward.
That does say a lot. I was curious, as a player, is sacrifice contagious? Like, it's not really something you can teach. Is it something, as it's happening, other players who may not have that same DNA are like, oh man, I got to do this. Victor Hedman's doing this, or Kucherov's doing this. Is it something that kind of seeps through the team as it's happening?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, blocking shots and sacrifice, whether, you know, that's taking a hit, or even that sacrifice of not making a play and, you know, realizing you gotta chip it in and maybe not try to go between the defenseman's legs. And that's a choice. Those are all choices you make, right? But when your top guys are making that choice and doing it, as you look at yourself and if you're another guy in that team, you say, you know, Stamkos is out there laying in front of shots, scored 60 goals in his career before, leads the team, like, he is just, how do I not go out there and do that same exact thing? And you want to do it. I mean, you see it happen. You see the bench reaction. You see how it lifts the team up. So it's contagious in that aspect. And then I think you eventually, through doing that year after year, you build that culture, that word everybody talks about, of a winning culture. You know, you build that. And then you get new guys that come in and they see that happening. It's something that's real. You could go into that room and you could feel it. You could see it on the ice. And if you want to fit in with that group, that's how you have to play. And you see that with new guys coming in with Hagel, you know, Nick Paul. You can see those guys that bought into that right away, because that culture and that leadership in that room is so strong that it's contagious.
I wanted to flip it, Ryan, to Florida and just talk about that culture and that what's contagious. With Tampa, when you were there too, you guys, you had those runs where you got close and you experienced that disappointment, you know, even though you knew how close you were. I look at Florida right now and I say, they haven't really got close, right? I mean, they lost in the first round last year. They lost in the second round this year, but they didn't even win a game. They scored 3 goals. So it's disappointing and it's frustrating, but they haven't had that complete heartache that you guys had when you were there that led to eventually what we're seeing now with the Lightning. So are the Panthers close after this season, or is there still just a lot of work to be done there about building that type of culture?
I think you're right, Dan, and that's what a lot of people don't, you know, talk about. You hear a lot about, even if you want to talk about Florida or Toronto losing in the first round again, you know, and everybody looks back at Tampa and says, you know, well, that team had to lose first before they learned how to win, which I think there's a huge part of that. But you got to remember, they went to a Stanley Cup Finals in 2015 with that core. They had 2 more conference finals with that core. So they had some pretty deep runs. They were close, right? So they learned how to get through those early rounds. And as you get to those late rounds, things change too. That conference finals and finals, those are different series as well. There's different emotions you're dealing with. There's different, you know, ups and downs throughout those series. So I think that was a huge part of them learning. Obviously, we know they got swept, you know, by Columbus that year. But those previous years, they were going deep into the playoffs and were pretty darn close. So, you know, as you look at this Florida team, do they have the nucleus and the guys to do it? I think they do. I mean, they're a very talented team. There's no question. You saw that in the regular season, and there's no denying that. But, you know, to say that, you know, you lose in the first round or you lose in the second round and all of a sudden you know how to win, I don't believe in that completely. You know, I've been in those late rounds, and, you know, those late rounds are a different animal. Because your emotions are so high, you're so close, you can feel it. You know, and how you control those emotions and how you control those waves of momentum through a game or, you know, in between games in a series is something you have to learn also. My biggest takeaway in 2015, and even talking to the guys in Tampa, was the way Chicago, when we entered that series, you know, their emotions never changed. They never were high and they never were low. They played the same exact way. And I think of us, and, you know, we lost game one, that we probably outplayed them. We outshot them. And myself included, I felt so down after the game, like, man, we really deserve that one. And then we go on to win the next two, and I felt so high, like, I think we're going to win the Stanley Cup, you know? So It's a different beast once you get to the finals, and a huge part of why Tampa had success and won two cups is they went through those later rounds and were that close to it and can taste it, and, you know, you have that huge letdown. It definitely lights a fire underneath you when you make it that far and you don't win it.
Do you think it's fair, the criticism that maybe Florida's leadership group has gotten, you know, Barkov and Huberdeau, for the failures that they've had, or is it deeper than that?
It's fair. There's no question. It's fair. When you're a top player, captain of the team, you know, lead the team at points, your top guys are going to get criticism if you don't have success. This isn't new to Florida, right? It's every team that gets knocked out of the playoffs or doesn't have playoff success or, you know, has high expectations, as Florida did, and obviously getting swept is a big thing. So it's fair. There's criticism. There should be. This is a league where you demand results. It's a results-based league. It's not you don't get participation medals handed out in the NHL. So I think the criticism is fair, but do I think that, you know, specifically those two guys, do they have it in them? 100%. I mean, those are two talented hockey players, Barkov and Huberdeau. I mean, it's amazing what they can do on the ice, and they don't have a ton of playoff experience, as we talked about experience before. So I think that's part of the process of them learning the NHL is getting some chances in the playoffs. It's not like they've been in the playoffs every year with Florida. This is new to them. This is a new journey for them. This is a new time of year that they haven't seen a ton of. So I'll give them the benefit of doubt on that. And I just know what type of players they are. And you know, I think their physicality, their bodies and everything else is built for playoffs, especially Barkov in particular. He uses his body so well. He doesn't shy away from, you know, the physical part of the game. But this is a roadblock in his career. Where does he go from here is the big thing for me. Does he learn from this and improve next year if they make the playoffs and we see a new Barkov come playoff time? That's when it will be telling for me, when you get a couple of playoffs in a row and you see how he responds and you see if he takes this loss in the correct way and learns from it.
All right, let's flip it to another one of your former teams, the Rangers, and they're playing the Hurricanes, and it's a 2-2 series after game four. The Rangers hold serve at home. The Hurricanes hold serve at home. They have not won a road game yet this playoffs, which is kind of odd for a team like this. But we talk about a team like the Hurricanes, who have been around for a while now. They've pushed here. They've been in this playoff mix. They got to a conference final a couple of years ago, and yet here they are really struggling to score, particularly with a power play that doesn't look like it's in sync, has much of a plan, which is a little surprising. What are you seeing from Carolina, particularly on the offensive end, with that power play?
Sometimes on a power play, I think there's two different issues with a power play. One of them can be trying to get entry into the zone with possession and have the puck, right? That's, I think, one problem that teams can have sometimes if the opposing team is doing a good job in the neutral zone, and that could get frustrating very quickly for a power play. But I don't see that as the issue. I feel like they've entered the zone fairly easy against the Rangers and getting set up, but it's in the zone is the team where they have their troubles. And you got to credit New York as well. They've pressured at all times. Any time they see a bobble or a loose puck, I mean, they're pressuring two, three guys and trying to outnumber the power play. But it's a weird thing, a power play. Everybody talks about confidence and, you know, that C word that it's hard to explain what it is. But, I mean, a power play really does live and die by that. It's a weird thing. I've been on power plays, and I've seen power plays where, you know, you get one goal and things are going good, and all of a sudden it just starts rolling. And then it could go the other way on you, and it almost takes a life of its own. You saw it in the Florida series. You know, it's what's talked about on the off days. You're watching video on it. You're working on it in, you know, practice. It's a funny thing where you get all these talented guys, but everybody's holding their stick a little bit tight, and You know how badly you want a power play goal, and it just seems to snowball on you. And that's what I'm seeing in Carolina right now, very similar to what happened in Florida. But come playoff time and special teams, you win and lose by special teams. And it's funny, I talked to Rob Rendemore. We had a game in Carolina. It was late in the season, and I asked him, I said, you know, what are the big things or what's the big key going into playoffs for your team? And his answer to me was special teams. He said the last two seasons that we lost out in the playoffs, the series that we lost, I felt we lost the special teams battle and it cost us the series. So going into playoffs, that's a big key for him. And right now against the New York Rangers, they're losing that special teams battle. And now we have a 2-2 series. So it's interesting. They know how important it is. It's just a hard thing once you start losing it to regain that confidence.
Does the fact that they're playing against Shesterkin add to that? I know their troubles with the power play have gone deeper. They're almost 2 months old now. But you talk about confidence, and you saw in the game yesterday, like, open nets where they missed. It seemed they were trying to be too fine. Is a problem that already exists made worse when you run into such a hot goaltender?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. It's been to the point where they have gotten some really good chances, and you know, Shesterkin's there and makes the save. It can play with your head. You can start overpassing it. You know, you start trying to shoot for that little corner and you end up missing the net. A good goalie like that, Shesterkin, can definitely play with a player's head or a power play's head to the fact that you almost feel like you got to pass it into the net to try to find an open net to beat them. And that's the last thing a struggling power play needs is to be overpassing it. Simplifying it is definitely the answer, but that's easier said than done when you got a guy like Shesterkin in the net that makes a lot of those, you know, shots from the outside seem like pretty easy saves, and there's not those second opportunities sometimes because he's good at controlling the rebounds as well. So it can play with you, and especially, you know, you could see when New York gets the lead as well. I mean, I've been on those benches playing against really good goalies, and all of a sudden you're down two and you're like, oh, wait a minute here, we got to get three against this guy now to win this game. Like, I don't know if that can happen. And I mean, Shesterkin being the goalie he is obviously doesn't help the issues of the power play by any means.
You know, and one of the things you know, with special teams, it's also the PK. And if you look at them, you know, the Rangers have scored a power play goal in each of the last two games. In game four, though, I wanted to ask you about this specific play here. When Trouba hits Domi and Steven Lorenz comes flying across the ice, and it's an instigator. I think that's a tough spot for a guy like Lorenz, because he's going in there to defend his teammate. He sees his teammate get hit pretty hard. His teammate's laying down, and he's going in to defend him. In the regular season, you probably don't even think twice about it, but in the playoffs, you do, right? I mean, what did you think when you saw that? And is Lorenz, does Lorenz there have to control his emotions, even though he sees his teammate get hit like that?
Yeah, I agree with you completely in the fact that in the regular season, that's not even thought about twice. That's a tap in the head, way to jump in there, even if you give up a power play goal, right? You stick up for your teammate. And that's the hard part about playoffs, is that's engraved in a hockey player's mind. You see your teammate, you know, go down like that, get hit, go in there and you stick up for him. But come playoff time, and as we just talked about how important special teams are, that's one of those ones where I feel like, and as hard as it is, and trust me, I've been in those situations and I've taken penalties myself in the playoffs doing it, you have to take a number. You're going to be on the ice again, you know, with Trouba. You know, and if you feel like you need retribution, that's where you challenge him to a fight, and you fight him, and you don't have that instigator penalty. But, you know, come playoff times, they always say, you know, take a punch in the face and don't retaliate. The same thing goes for your teammates. If you see a teammate get hit like that, you have to try to control those emotions. It's too big of a power play for the New York Rangers for you to fly in there and take a two-minute instigator. So I agree with you in the fact that, you know, the better play is to try to not go in there. Are the guys in the room or everybody else, you know, mad at him or anything like that? No. I mean, he's trying to stick up for his teammate. You know, his heart's in the right place. The guys know that. That's a penalty as a teammate that you want to kill off really bad. Like, you're like, let's get this one for this guy. They end up scoring on the power play, I know. But that's the crazy emotions of playoffs. The right play there is to take a number, you know, even go in there and grab them, say a word or two to them. You know, we'll catch you later in the game. But to fly in there and take that instigator penalty, it proves very, very costly in the game. And that's how you got to try to control those emotions in the playoffs sometimes.
We've talked about the East, and it's been traditional playoff hockey. Goals have been tough to come by in both series. Now we go out to the West, and it's just – it's 1980s hockey, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that it seems like we were talking about Barkov before and having to try and figure it out and not having a ton of playoff success. Here's Connor McDavid, who finally seems to have figured it out and is carrying that Edmonton team on his back.
And what Connor McDavid's doing is, I don't know if I have words for it, to be honest with you. It's unbelievable. I mean, it is so fun to watch the level that he has risen his game to, which I didn't think was possible. I didn't think there was another level that he had. But there is, and you're seeing it. I mean, he's willing his team, through this Calgary series. And you can see that, and we talk about, earlier we talked about being contagious, you know, that leadership of everything else. It seems like his drive and the level he's brought to Edmonton, it has been contagious for the guys around him. I mean, Evander Kane, the way he's playing, Dreisaitl, the way he's playing, Hyman, I go down that list of forwards that have seemed to elevate their game after watching McDavid do what he does. I think that's a huge part of it. And I sit there in awe every night as I watch him. Every shift, he's on the ice. He's doing something special, creating. And, you know, I think we're really seeing in this Calgary series now what I call the McDavid effect of, you know, it's not just bending him. It's the other five guys around the ice are so aware of where he is, worried about trying to help their teammate out that's, you know, got him right now one-on-one, that there's other guys on the ice. And McDavid, what makes him so special is he could be at top speed, moving his feet, one-on-one as a defender, and he know his hockey awareness and where everybody else on the ice so good that he's making these backhand passes through feet, and his teammates are open because everybody's so worried about him. Other guys are going to be open, and he has the talent enough to draw players to him and continue to go at top speeds and still find those guys. And that's what's impressive to me, and his edge work, his strength in his skates to be able to, you know, shrug Branson off, and then also his talent of beating Markstrom. So, yeah, I mean, I can't say enough about the guy. It's really impressive.
And Ryan, I think what you're saying is right. He's dragging everybody else into the fight too. And that game four was a perfect example of it too. And, you know, I mean, cause Nugent Hopkins gets a couple, Kane's had a really good playoffs, obviously, but what impressed me most about them in game four and how they took this lead in the series, the way they have this stranglehold on it, is the way they responded after that 140, whatever foot goal that Mike Smith gave up. Right. I mean, that's a backbreaker. Calgary, you're up 3-0. Calgary's come back. They tie the game on that goal. And what happens? The Oilers just shrug it off like a team that's been there, done that, which they haven't. And they come out and they get the next one. And it's Nugent Hopkins at the doorstep, gets the next one, and they go on to win the game. I thought that was a real telltale sign of how far this team has come, really.
I completely agree with you. You're right. I mean, that's killer. And I think you felt for Smitty, and because he's after game one, he's been unbelievable for them, right? At the age of 40, I don't know if people are talking about enough about the series he's having right now against a very talented offensive team in Calgary, right? I mean, their top line, each guy had 40-plus goals in the regular season. This team can score goals on you, and Smitty's been unreal in net for them, and then you see him let that one in. You know, and I think on the bench and as a team, that's almost like, talk about being in a letdown, but it's almost a rallying point too, right? You're like, boys, we can't, just for Smitty alone, we can't get this one get away from us, right? It's so good for us in this series. We have to go out there and try to get that back for him. So that's almost too, like, I've been on the bench before where things like that happen, and it's almost like a rallying point where you're like, not to our guy. We can't let this happen to our guy and lose this game. He's been way, way too good for us.
How hard is it to be in the situation St. Louis is in, where they thought for sure that they had a chance against Colorado? Bennington's playing. He might be the best goalie in the playoffs at the point he was at. And then he gets hurt and everything's kind of going sideways. And now, you know, going into tonight, as we tape this, they're facing an elimination that they thought 4 days ago wasn't even close.
Yeah, that's tough. And that's how quickly a playoff series can turn on you, right? It's bang, bang, and all of a sudden you're down 3-1. And you're right, Binnington was playing unbelievable. Obviously what happened there with Kadri, the collision, it's unfortunate. You never want, you know, to see a goalie go down and be hurt like that. But kind of what was surprising to me in the last game and all the noise, obviously, around Kadri and what was going on. And I thought St. Louis was just very undisciplined, right? You know, the way they ran around after him, took penalties on him. That surprised me as a veteran team and a well-coached team that they did that. You know, Kadri's a guy that likes to stir it up, likes to agitate. I feel like he plays so much better when he's playing that game and guys are going after him, and you saw it in that game, he ended up getting a hat trick. But they played right into his hands, right? That's what he wants. He wants guys running around after him. He wants them to take the extra shot at him. So I was just surprised that, you know, St. Louis did that. Did I think there was going to be a response to it? I absolutely did. I thought maybe someone would challenge him, try to fight him. But that wasn't the response I thought that was going to happen, where they chased him around the ice and took the penalties they did. I mean, Kadri will invite that all day, right? So that's the difference in the series for me right there. It's, you know, it's either 3-1 or 2-2 after that game. And they go out there, they're undisciplined, uncharacteristic for a veteran team that knows how big that stage is and who has won before. And I thought, you know, Kadri's basically living rent-free in their head there in that game, and it cost them. But, you know, so it's, I was surprised by that. That really surprised me about that. And I was just, I'd be honest, I was so happy for Kadri, too, to get the hat trick in that game. And not so much what was going on the ice, but everything that was happening off the ice with him. It's sad to see, in today's world, that stuff still goes on. And at the end of the day, I love the passion for fans have, the care fans have, but it's a game, you know. They're playing a game out there. Things happen quick. I didn't even think it was a goalie, you know, there was an accidental contact with Binnington, and to see people take it that far and what was happening, it's just terrible to see. And I feel bad for Kadri and his family that have to go through that. But, man, what a response by him, and what character to be able to come out in a game like that after all the noise that was happening and have a performance like that. So good on him.
Very well said, Ryan. Very well said. And I think that's a great note. We can end on that right there. So appreciate all the time you gave us today, and enjoy the rest of the playoffs, man. All right.
Awesome, guys. Same to you. Talk soon.
Great stuff there from Ryan and Sean. Really well said. Like I said at the end, before we signed off with him, about what he said about Nazem Kadri, how he put it. I don't think I could have put it any better myself. And it is, you know, look, I mean, with the way Kadri handled that situation, remarkable. And then the way he handled it on the ice, even more remarkable. Well, as remarkable, I shouldn't say more remarkable, as remarkable for doing his job, the way he did it that night and getting a hat trick and turning that series on, you know, on its ear, really. I mean, it was very impressive work from a guy who has been, you know, for his on-ice stuff in the playoffs on the wrong end of a lot of things in his career, for doing what he shouldn't be doing. Not only did he do the right thing there, or the only thing he could really do, he handled it so well off the ice, and on the ice, he just dominated. It was just great to see.
Yeah, no, it was one of the special performances of the playoffs so far, for sure. And you know, embraced it, right? Like Ryan said it, like some players love it. You know, a couple of his teammates said he likes being the villain. And I don't know that he's a villain per se. Like, we make storylines. Sports is a soap opera, right? And there has to be heels and there has to be good guys. And Nazem's always kind of sat in that heel category. And some of it's been very well earned. And some of it with St. Louis, you know, Ryan Callahan's like, I'm somewhat surprised at their lack of discipline. You go back in the history, you know, with Nazem in the last 2 years, and there's a lot there to digest, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was a talking point at the beginning of the series, and everybody said it was gone, that Nazem had to answer the bell twice during the regular season for what he did in the playoffs last year, for which he was suspended. And, you know, and then all that raw emotions comes back when Binnington gets hurt. I mean, that is a crushing blow. Jordan Binnington was nowhere. Like, he had lost the starting job. He's the cup-winning goalie from 3 years ago. And he was in the wilderness again, where he started his career. He had lost the starting job. He had no confidence. Ville Husso was the starter going into the playoffs, gets a shutout in game one, and then the wheels come off a little bit. And Craig Berube's made a lot of great decisions in these playoffs, and deciding to go to Binnington in four was one of them, because it gave him an out. If Binnington was still no good, he could go back to Husso without the series being on the line per se. But he wasn't. He was great. He had the best save percentage, you know, and it was a small sample, but he was back to the Jordan Binnington from 2019. And then he's sitting in the press box with his knee torn up because of an accident. But you don't take it that way. I wouldn't expect anybody to take it. Like, you're upset. Your teammates are upset. That was your best chance to win, and it was taken away from you, whether it was justly or unjustly. You're going to lead towards unjustly because of the history and everything else. So, but Ville Husso has not been the answer since he's come back. He's given up 9 goals on 50 shots. And some of them haven't been good, and some of them have been real backbreakers. And you can't do that against a Colorado team that in the snap of a finger can just turn the offense on and put you away.
Sean, I don't think the Blues should have, could have. They can't react the way they did. You can't do that. And it goes back to, you know, what I asked Ryan Callahan about, you know, about Steven Lorenz in the Carolina Rangers series. Your natural instinct is to do that. I get it. But the teams that don't are the teams that win. And that's the difference. And the Blues know that. They know that. And they still did it. And I think Craig Berube's made some terrific decisions. I think he's a terrific coach. But he also helped fuel that. Right. I mean, he brought up Kadri's history, you know, you look at the player and whatnot. So it's not like I'm not blaming him necessarily, but they have to show better discipline. They just have to take a number next year. Do it a different time. You've got to show better discipline. You got a guy in net who has now been your goalie for a lot of the season. You don't want to see Binnington gets hurt. I get that. Do the right thing for the goalie in the net now. Don't put him in a bad spot.
I don't agree with you at all about Craig Berube. I thought, you know, after the game, he's pissed. And he says, look at the player. And I think that's a fair complaint. Look at the player and look what he's done. And then the next day, he wouldn't take the bait.
That's true.
The water was full of chum. They were laying it out. They were saying, come on, Craig, you're going to lose it. Here we go. And he wouldn't take the bait. That's done. That's not our concern. It doesn't help us to talk about it. It's in the past. This is the future. He set the right tone for his team, in my opinion. But you can only fight human nature so much. Yeah. This is a tight group. And again, Jordan Binnington at that point was their best chance to win. They're the underdog. There's no question about it. Colorado's the best team in the West. And your best player, your best weapon to neutralize them is now sitting in a suit in the press box through no fault of his own. Of course, there's going to be raw emotions there. And maybe they can't do what they did. But to me, it happens in every hockey game. And I just think, you know, they got punished in a way because of the way that Colorado is offensively, that maybe other teams might not have got punished. So were they going to win this series anyways? I don't know. But their best chance to win it wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. Smaller scale, obviously, and nobody got hurt on the play. But, I mean, after game three of the Rangers-Hurricanes series, Gerard Gallant was pretty strong about what he felt at the end of the game. The cheap shot Max Domi took on Ryan Lindgren and yelling at Tony DeAngelo, yelling at the bench, and Gallant yelling back at him, telling him to grow up. And, you know, he expressed his frustration with that after the game. And then the next day, he kind of did the same thing as Greg Berube did. He wouldn't take the bait. He said, we moved on from it. It's over. And then what happens? Jacob Trouba goes and hits Max Domi, who was part of that, you know, at the end. And Steven Lorenz flies in, draws the instigator minor. Rangers score on the power play. Rangers win game four. Series is tied up. So not the same scale, obviously, because Jordan Binnington, their starting goalie for the Blues, is sitting out. Nobody's sitting out right now in that Carolina Rangers series. But it's about that, you know, discipline. It's about, you know, situations. Coaches trying to set the right tone, I guess. And still things happening on the ice. So, but the Binnington-Husso thing to me is interesting now, Sean, because it, like, beginning of the playoffs, end of the regular season. I mean, I thought the Blues had a real hard decision on their hands, right? A real hard decision. What do you do here, right? Bennington signed. He won you the cup. Huso is a pending unrestricted free agent. How do you handle this, right? Huso's become your number one guy. Well, not anymore. And I think the question is gone. Like, it's Bennington. And I could see Ville Husso's rights getting traded before the draft or something like that, because, you know, team's going to want him. And he will be wanted, and they'll try to get something for him. But pretty sure the Blues know that Jordan Bennington is their guy.
The only issue could be cost certainty, right? Like, Jordan Bennington's making $6 million a year. This is a cap team, right? Can you get a really good goalie on a much cheaper deal? Maybe. But I think if you want the known quantity, and again, the only question really is Jordan's been up and down, and are you going to ride the next up cycle? And to me, that's the decision. It's the proven commodity. And, you know, I think Ville Husso, as good as he's been, was not as good down the stretch of the regular season, and has not, other than game one against Minnesota, been very good in the playoffs. And I think that's the cauldron by which you decide the value of players, because that's the ultimate in competition. So it'll be an interesting decision. But I also think, you know, what we just talked about is coaches setting the tones for their teams and trying to do the right things. And as all of these playoffs have been going on, and there's some really good coaches involved in the playoffs, the coaching landscape outside of the playoffs is just wild right now. You know, since last time we talked, Rick Bowness has stepped down in Dallas, and congratulations to him on an unbelievable career. One of the nicest men I've ever met in hockey. And this last couple of years run that he's had with Dallas has been so awesome. Like, for him to get the recognition that he never really got in his career for being the ultimate hockey lifer, and to do the things that he did with Dallas is unbelievable, you know. And then it seems like the Philadelphia Flyers have been looking for a coach forever. And now, you know, it comes out this week that John Tortorella's interviewing there. And you talk about a perfect personality for Philadelphia. I think Torts is that. I don't know if he's the right coach. I think he'd be very accepted. His bluntness certainly would be accepted. He has a Philly quote unquote attitude, and that would be accepted for sure. But I don't know if it's the right play for this team at this time.
I don't know either, but I do know that isn't a team that's so super skilled, you know what I mean? And they're a team that I think could buy into the way Tortorella likes his teams to play. And I think they could buy into it without much pushback, to be honest with you. They have a young goalie that needs to be better, that they want to build around, put a better defensive system around him. That obviously helps too. But a defensive system with the ability to push for offense, because there is some skill there. It's just not a super skilled team. Like, I mean, they're not the Panthers. They're not, you know what I mean? Like, they don't have that type of guy. I actually think it could be a pretty good fit with Tortorella there in Philadelphia. They're young-ish. They're not veteran laden necessarily, but they're not all like up and comers either, you know? So it wouldn't be like, that's a team that I think with the right system in place, with the right coach in place, and with a goalie who comes back, that's a team I think could make some noise the next season. I do think that. And Tortorella, if you're Chuck Fletcher and you're thinking to yourself, we got to do something. We can't go into a rebuild here. I'm not going to survive that. Nobody here will survive that. Torts, I think, might be the right guy to help that, you know, team out. So would Barry Trotz, let's be honest. And I think the whole coaching landscape, you know, starts with Barry Trotz. I think, you know, the domino fall, he's the first one to go, in my opinion, I think. And he also apparently is interviewing with the Flyers as well. So I think he's the first one to go. But I could see Torts as a fit in Philadelphia, and the personalities alone do match.
Well, you would know this better than I, having covered them both extensively. But aren't you just going back to Vigneault, who you just walked away from a coach and a half ago, and saying, here's my authoritarian systems guy who's going to make life quasi-miserable for the players, And less than 15 months ago, you were like, that's not for us anymore. We can't do that.
No. And the reason I say no is because the styles are different. I think Alain Vigneault, from what I know of him, and look, it's hard to complain. He's had success in different markets he's been in, is more of like a CEO. You know, he's not in the weeds as much with the guys, whereas Torts is in the weeds. Torts is on the ice. He's grinding with all of them. He's non-stop one-on-one coaching along those lines. So I don't think it's the same. It's the same in the sense of it's a veteran guy, my way or not, or no way. I get that, right? But I also believe that Torts, through his experience in Columbus, learned, and this is why I think the Blue Jackets were a pretty good team under him, is he learned how to work within the players that he's get, work with the players that he's got, and you and their skill sets didn't pigeonhole them. There was pigeonholing in New York when he was with the Rangers. There was no question about that. Trying to just say, no, this is what you have to do. I don't care your skill set. This is what you have to do. He didn't do that in Columbus. And he's right down with those guys in terms of coaching and grinding with them and teaching. Nobody teaches. Nobody loves teaching the game, I think, more than John Tortorella, to be honest with you. So I think it's a little bit different. And I think, you know, he'll work within the personality of the players and personality of their games, probably a little bit better than AV.
See, you did know better than I.
I don't know if I'm right.
But you made it sound convincing, like you always do, like you have throughout this whole podcast. But we both have places to be very soon. So yes. I think we've come to a natural end to this week's podcast, Dan.
I think you're 100% right, because we both have places to go, playoffs to cover, lots of action still to come in the playoffs. We thank Ryan Callahan for jumping on with us. Got any questions for us on Twitter, at the rink, at @SRourke_NHL and @DRosenNHL. And you know what? A lot of playoff hockey coming at you, so enjoy it.